Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know. He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package gonna go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Okay, system got stuck a little bit. Today's It's My House is titled Mathematicians Starting Five. Mathematicians Starting Five. This podcast was inspired by one of our listeners. We're working on getting the math doctor on, thanks to his suggestion, working on that. Anyway, but today's podcast is Mathematician Starting Five, the Women's Edition. And this comes out of the Mount Rushmore concept, too. Typically, when people do a Mount Rushmore, well, it depends on what circle of people you're around. You know, what's your Mount Rushmore of, you know, the NFL, the NBA, entertainers, that type of stuff. But what about who's your Mount Rushmore, who's your starting five, when it comes to the math, the sciences, and other topics, which are vitally important? So that's why today we're going to take a look at the mathematicians' starting five for black women mathematicians. That's what we're going to do today. And we're working on getting the math doctor on. So let's start off with him.
the name of Allah, God, the beneficent, the most merciful. I bear witness there's no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger. I greet you all with the greeting words of peace. Assalamu alaikum.
Buenas
tardes. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hotel. And what up?
What up?
I would like to first begin by thanking God for allowing me to be here. Just very humbled by the proclamations and the beautiful words. Never ever in my life have I received a proclamation, so I was wondering what Shahid Muhammad she was talking about. I would like to also thank our hardworking sister soldier on a battlefield for education. Can we give it up one more time for Sister Eva Doyle? We thank the mayor, we thank the city council, thank everyone that has something to do with putting this program on, for the proclamations, and we thank, most importantly, you all for coming out on a Saturday afternoon to hear something about mathematics. You don't know how blown away I am that there's people in the seat. Now, the title she gave me to deal with is Building Mathematical Power in Students of Color. Now, in order to build anything, you have to first make an assessment of what's already there. So every building that goes up, every building that goes up, we first have to assess what's already on the land. Is that right? An analysis must be made to see how strong the foundation is, because you cannot build anything without a strong foundation. So the question is, what is the state, the condition of students of color in regards to mathematics achievement? Well, many of you already know. That's why you all are here. But before we even go to students of color, let's just look at America in general. What is the state of the American students overall in regards to mathematics? And if we know the statistics, we will see that we are in a state of emergency. It is really cold red when we look at how our students are performing versus other students on the planet Earth.
Yes, sir.
So let us bring up some stats. These statistics here are the international test that they give for 8th graders and 12th graders. So we see U.S. students, that's overall, ranked 28th out of 41 for math. That's not good at all. And then 12th graders ranked 19 out of 21. That's doggone near the bottom. So here we have all the biggest, richest country on the planet. But when it comes to math achievement, we are at the bottom of the list in regards to international tests. Now, if we look at our report card, you know there's this organization called the National Assessment of Education Progress. They put out a report card on U.S. progress. Well, it says 26% of U.S. 12th graders are proficient in mathematics. Now that's proficient, that's not mastery, that's just proficient. Then 39% do not have the math skills that's needed. Well, 39% do have the math skills needed for college entry. That means 61% of U.S. graduates coming out of school are not ready for college in mathematics. Now I teach at Malcolm X College in Chicago, and one of the main focuses that we're dealing with are what are called developmental math. We teach almost more developmental math than we do regular math, than we do higher math. So before we even talk about students of color, we see just in America, period, mathematics achievement and proficiency is low. Now, you know that if anybody else is suffering a cold, then you know black and Hispanics, we're suffering cancer. Is that right? So if the American students are doing terrible, what is happening with us, Hispanics, blacks, and Native Americans? Well, let's look at the statistics. 12% of 8th grade black boys are proficient in math, compared with 44% of white boys. In 2013, the National Assessment of Education Progress reported and showed on the bar graph that blacks scored the lowest
out of all ethnic groups. The next group next to us were our Hispanic family brothers and sisters. Now, another stat that might blow your mind. 70% of special ed students are black students. And that seems to be a very large percentage to me. I don't know how it bothers you. Then, there's statistics on those labeled mentally retarded. Some studies show that black children are almost three times more likely to be labeled mentally retarded than their white counterparts. Now, does that mean that black children are just inherently born needing special ed? Are they just inherently born mentally retarded? Or is there maybe something going on in the educational system? Is there something going on in the educational system that labels in particular black boys troublemakers when they are not doing what the teacher wants them necessarily to do? And we're going to get into why some of them act out. Now, so as we as ethnic groups, blacks, Hispanics, and Native Americans, are we just born inferior in mathematics? Do we just have a problem learning math? Or has something happened to all of us? If we check history, we know that our black, brown, and red family, we were all hit in the head by the same enemy. Is that right?
Amen.
We were robbed of our natural ability to demonstrate intellectual prowess. And definitely, we were not allowed to display skills and mastery in mathematics. Now, there's a quote that Imam Elijah Muhammad came up with. He says, any man that won't treat you right, why are you expecting them to teach you right? And we have 460-year history of not being treated right, but yet we're sending our children to their schools and wondering why they're 70% labeled special ed, wondering why they're at the bottom in mathematics proficiency. See, those in power and that subjugate people, they know that a people strong in math are hard to subjugate, hard to control, and hard to oppress. So they made sure that mathematics was not something that black, Hispanic, and Native Americans mastered. Let me bring up the testimonial of a slave. There's a book called Bull with Days. You need to get that book. In that book, these are slave narratives, not somebody writing down what the slave said, but this is a direct quote from slaves. Listen to what this slave, Hal Hudson, has to say about mathematics. This is his quote now. Now, he uses a certain word. I'm going to change it just for being politically correct. He said, if I was caught trying to read or figure which means doing mathematics, they would whip me something terrible. Master Brown would often say, my God Almighty, never do for that N-word to learn to figure. Now, this is what the master said. And if he was caught reading or learning how to do math, they would whip him terribly. So this was going on the plantation, so it's no wonder now that we seem to be at the bottom in mathematic proficiency. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad said that a people who do not know mathematics will always be subject to a people that do. So if in my mind I want to keep you down, I'm going to make sure that you are not mathematically proficient, that this is something that you perceive as difficult and run away from, so that I can keep you down and keep you subjugated. So, what is the real deal? Are we just naturally born mathematically illiterate? It's just something that's not cut out for black people, for Hispanic people, for Native Americans. Well, let's go to the real deal. Now, you don't get the real deal in the schools. Because in many of the books that I learned and studied from in terms of mathematical history, you rarely see anybody black in the book. It's like we don't even exist. We didn't give any contribution at all to mathematics. Now, they have something in Chicago in the city colleges called a math emporium. And this is a place where you can sit in your class and learn math and do math labs and so forth. And when you walk in the lobby, they have a wall of great mathematicians. And I looked at the wall. And this is a city college that is in the hood. And the mathematicians in that city college contributed to the wall. There was not one woman on the wall and no people of color at all. So what signal does that teach me as a black person, a Hispanic person, a Native American? You got a wall of great mathematicians and none of them look like me.
Yeah.
Maybe I need to keep rapping, playing ball, dancing, doing something that I see my people doing. Well, what's the real deal? The Egyptians were doing higher order, complex mathematics while the Europeans were in the Dark Ages. It was the black Moors, the black Muslims, that brought math and science to the Europeans while they were in the Dark Ages and helped them get out of the Dark Ages. Do we have any evidence? Well, we have this thing called the Rhine Papyrus. This is just one of the many evidences that are out there. What is this Rhine Papyrus? Well, we know papyrus means paper. This is the paper that the Egyptians used, and this is where we get the word paper from. But the Rhine Mathematical Papyrus is one of the oldest preserved mathematical documents. The papyrus was about 18 feet long, 13 inches wide, and it was written in hieratic script. I'm saying it wrong. Please forgive me. On both sides with red and black ink, as you see here. It includes 85 worked out problems, most of which were arithmetic and geometric progression. There's evidence of algebra on them, evidence of geometry, evidence of calculus, and beyond. But when you read historical books, they tell you that the Egyptians had a simple understanding of mathematics, that the Greeks took it to a higher level. Interesting. So the Rhine Mathematical Papyrus, which is also known as the Ames Papyrus, is a major source of our knowledge of the mathematics of Egypt. It was apparently found during illegal excavations. Very interesting. Now, we know in Egypt we have what is called the Great Pyramids of Giza. My wife and I were able to go there, look at those pyramids, and touch them. It's awe-inspiring. It'll blow you away. How in the world were they able to build them? And you got all type of theories today. Is that right? They say aliens built them. Got all type of crazy madness because they don't want to give the credit to the black people that had a higher form of mathematics. That's why they were able to build those pyramids. Even in the indigenous family, they had superior cultures. They built pyramids. You go down to Mexico, Cancun, you got pyramids there that look like the pyramids in Africa. Is that right? But you can't build a pyramid with low lambskins. But yet we're taught that we had very little contribution to mathematics. Let's go to an article on myths, truths, and lies about mathematicians in the African diaspora. Now, this was put out, very interesting, by the Department of the State University right here in Buffalo. I didn't make that up. Just an impression. Look what it says. A century before U.S. slavery was ended, slaves and even ordinary African slave traders demonstrated mathematical abilities more sophisticated than the European bodies. That means the slaves and the slave traders knew more math than those Europeans buying slaves. But yet when we came over here, they made sure they cut off the adults, raised the children as babies to be mathematically illiterate, wouldn't even let them read and write. Now, purely Eurocentric origins of mathematics can no longer be upheld. The oldest, 35,000 BC, mathematical object was found in Swaziland. The oldest example of arithmetic was found in Zaire. The 4,000-year-old Moscow papyrus contains geometry, the consequence of the formula for the volume of a truncated square pyramid. From Herodotus to Proclus to Aristotle, Egypt was the cradle of mathematics. From the earliest, the great Greek mathematicians, including Pythagoras, Thales, and Exodus, all learned much of their math from where? From Egypt. But our children are not getting this, so they don't think that they have the ability, the mindset, to be masters of mathematics. Now the question is, what happened then? How do we go from being the originators, the creators of mathematics, to today being at the bottom of every statistic in mathematics? It has a lot to do with our culture in terms of not appreciating and valuing education, but it's got shown up a lot to do with these school systems that are not teaching our children and preparing them mathematically. So how do we rebuild this crumbling foundation? That's what we're here to talk about. How do we put mathematical power in students of color? Well, number one, we must teach our children a thorough knowledge of self. They have to know who they are. They have to know real history, not just slave history that we give them during February. They got to go to the root. They got to go back to Africa. Then they got to know it wasn't called Africa originally. They got to go back to the creation of the sun, the moon, the stars, and know that they were there. They must have role models in mathematics that look like them. All research shows that students that have teachers that look like them, that come from the same culture, do better than those taught by somebody else. Let me ask you this question. Would you ever go to a school and see wildebeest learning from lion teachers? Would you ever go to a school and see sheep being taught by wolves? We're the only people on the planet that put our children in our former slave master schools and expect everything to be all right. Look at the statistics. 85% now, approximately 3 million of the nation's estimated 3.5 million K-12 teachers are white, translates into about 85%. So now you have some good white teachers that do the best that they can. But our children need to see, Hispanic children need to see, Native American children need to see teachers that look like them, speak like them, have the same culture, have the same rhythm and understanding like them. So maybe these children of ours won't be 70% put into special ed. Because they're taught by somebody that understands their reality and their mindset. Where are the black, Hispanic, and Native American mathematicians that our children can look up to and have as role models? See, our children know for sure that they can sing. They know they can dance. Because on the YouTube, you got all these nay-nay videos. Is that right? They know they can do the ball. They know they can sport. They know they can play. They know they can be comedians, actors, and engineers. But what about scientists, mathematicians, and engineers? How many do they see on TV that look like them? How many do they see in the school that look like them? That has a great effect on their confidence and ability to do the mathematics. That's right. So I'm going to do a little experiment right now with you if everybody's all right. I'm going to ask you to just raise your hand. Can you do that for me? Not now, but after the question. How many of you can name five black or Hispanic rappers? Just put your hand in there. You can name it five. Black or Hispanic rappers. Hip hoppers. Grab the mic and spit. Okay. Some of you are looking at me like you're crazy. How many of you can name me five black or Hispanic or Native American sports stars? Oh, yeah, everybody, right? How about comedians? Actresses or actors? All right, those are difficult questions, weren't they? Now, how many can name me five black or Hispanic mathematicians? Wow. Look around the audience. Everywhere I go, whether it's children, adults, or teachers, I rarely get one hand that goes up. You all can? Very good. Very proud of you. Might have to have a prize for you at the end. But when I ask in college, they look at me like I cursed. What do you mean? Because they can't name one. But we have some that you'll be able to see today. Imhotep, a powerful mathematician. Most of our students know Imhotep from the Mummy movies. And that Imhotep wasn't the real Imhotep. That's Hollywood Imhotep, a Caucasian. Imhotep wasn't a Caucasian. There's a bust of him right there. He was a pyramid builder, a doctor, mathematician, and engineer. See, the way we rolled back then, we didn't just major in one thing. He's majoring in three of the most difficult professions. Just being an engineer alone is enough. Most of us be happy to make that. This brother of ours was a doctor, mathematician, had time on the side to build pyramids. That was just his hobby. You got, here he is again, okay. You got, come on, start acting up now. Okay. Got a little, there we go. You got our sister Hypatia, who is an Egyptian mathematician. That's for all the girls in the class. Because you know there's this fallacy that math is cut out for just boys.
Yes.
Which I don't understand, because in my 20-some years of teaching, I found that most of my top students, many of them were the girls. Because they were more mature, more disciplined, right? Our boys, unfortunately, a lot of times are giggling and acting silly. Now, who is Philip Emeagwali? Does anybody know? Okay. Here he is right there. There's a little picture of him. Notice behind him, he's got some formulas going on. Petroleum companies hired him for his math skills. He's got serious math swag, right? So how many have ever seen him before? Maybe on BET, CNN, Time Magazine? Never seen him before, huh? Maybe two of y'all. And so we got some conscious people in here that might be reading or doing something. But on the regular programs, nobody knows him. How many use the internet? Put your hand in the air. How many can spell internet? Okay. Trying to get 100% hands. Some of y'all haven't waved your hand yet. If you use the internet, it's a shame we don't know him. Because without him, there would be no internet. He's an internet pioneer. Not only that, he's an engineer. He's a supercomputer scientist, a mathematician, and an internet pioneer. He's a self-taught mathematician. They asked him, how did you do so well in math? He said, I solve 100 math problems a day. And our children don't know him, but they on the internet all day.
Yeah.
Don't you think that would inspire them? Don't you think that would motivate them in the math class to know that a mathematician has something to do with the internet? And they should also know that this brother is not poor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's getting fat dollars, not from his rap skills, not from selling drugs, but from his mathematics.
Yeah.
These are the things our children need to be aware of.
That's right.
Now, another thing that you need to do in order to build mathematical power is you've got to teach children why in the world do I need to learn math in the first place. Mm-hmm. You don't seem like nothing to me but a bunch of numbers and letters that don't make no sense. Most math classes, the math teacher rarely tells the children why they need to learn math. And if the child asks a question, you hear the same old answer. Because you need to be able to count your money. These children are very sophisticated today. That might have worked in 1940, but that's not going to work in 2015, 2016 with our children.
That's right.
That are technologically savvy, is that right? They want to know a real root reason of why I need to learn math. Uh-huh. It's not just so you can count your money. Because you can pay somebody to count your money. Might not want to do that because a lot of parents are robbing. But in my class, I give them a full PowerPoint presentation. I was going to give it to you, but time is of the essence, and I can't do two at the same time. But I'll just give you a little appetizer of it. And I give them a thorough voyage of what they need to know of why mathematics is crucial. It's not just so you can learn. It's not just so you can go to the next level. It's not so you can get a college degree and get a job. Mathematics is universal. They need to know that when they look in the mirror, they're looking at a mathematical body.
Right.
Their human body is a perfectly run mathematical machine. Is that right?
Yeah.
There's a relationship between height and weight that's mathematical. You have a certain width of arteries for a healthy blood flow to go through. You eat too much grease and fatty foods, that shrinks. That's mathematics. You slow down the blood flow. You cause heart disease. You even have a heartbeat, that's a rate. That's a mathematics. Your heart beat too fast, you get a heart attack. Your heart beat too slow, you get confined to the bed. Like in the movie John Q with Denzel Washington, that little black boy had a heartbeat that was too slow. Is that right? There's 206 bones. There's 9 systems in the body. One more of the brain making 10. They need to know that their whole body is mathematics. So that means if I love myself, I love mathematics because mathematics is my subject. But they're not taught like that in these schools. They need to know that their body from head to toe is mathematics. I ask the students, how many of y'all like to eat? And I'll ask you, how many of y'all like food? Very good. Somebody had to prepare their food, right? First of all, the food had to come from a farm. And you can't be a farmer and not know mathematics. Because you got to know yield time. You got to know how far to put the seed in the ground. You got to know what time to water it, what time to cultivate it, what time is harvest time. All that's mathematics. Then when you cook food, don't you got to cook it a certain amount of time? Don't you got to cook it at a certain temperature? Don't you got fractions in the recipe? And if you don't know how to read a fraction, you don't know how to read your recipe. It's say a fourth cup of tea, salt, and you don't know what a fourth is. So you just guesstimate. That looks like about a fourth. Thing blow up in the oven. So a good cook is a mathematician. Because you've got to have mathematics in order to make that food taste good. And then a good cook and baker knows how to make the food not just taste good, but look good. And when food look good, that's geometry.
All right.
If you cut that piece of pie, that's a triangle. Is that right? Some of y'all getting excited right now. Even do we have any food for them after the program. Every sport, I tell my students, uses mathematics. You cannot name me a sport where math is not used. Basketball uses high algebra 2 quadratic functions. Because when you shoot the ball, you jump up in the air, the ball travels, reaches a maximum point, and comes down. That's a parabola. That's a quadratic function. So every time LeBron slams dunks or somebody else slams, they're using a quadratic formula. They don't know about it. When you play football, you got X's and O's. That's like the variables in algebra. Is that right? You got to know how much a yard is. The coach tell you run 20 yards for the practice. You don't even know what a yard is. You're looking kind of crazy. In baseball, you got batting averages. Is that right?
Yeah.
How many of you play pool in here? Billions. You got to hit it at the right speed. Is that correct? You got to hit it at the right angle.
Yeah, right.
When you dive into the water, you got to dive at the right angle or you can break your neck hitting the water.
Yeah.
Every sport requires mathematics. See, if the students knew this, then now everything I'm looking at, everything I'm dealing with, mathematics is required. I better get my math on.
Yes, sir.
But as long as it's something you need to go to the next level, it's something you need because you got to count your money, then they tuned out. But you got to show them math is important. What about music? You can't make good music without mathematics.
That's right.
That is bad music. That's music that's not mathematical. But every music that you like, R&B, hip-hop, salsa, whatever, it's got a beat to it, it's got rhythm to it, that means it's got mathematics.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to do for you, what I do for the students, I'm going to kick two beats for you. Yes, this little skinny body, I'm going to beatbox for you. The first beat is not going to have any mathematics, and you tell me whether you like it. The second beat is going to be mathematical. That means there's going to be a pattern, there's going to be rhythm, there's going to be a numerical sequence there. Are you ready? You sound kind of weak. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Here's the first one without math. That's terrible, isn't it? Now here's the beat with mathematics. Are you ready? When you sing a song, you got to be in tune with what? The beat. So when you all do karaoke, is that right? Hopefully you're not drunk when you do it. You're in tune with the beat. That's mathematics. Movies. When they make movies, they have stunts. They have a stunt coordinator. If you are the stunt person, you don't want your stunt coordinator or your stunt engineer to have a C in math.
Yes, sir.
I wouldn't do the stunt. Because there's many movies, I don't have a PowerPoint available, but there's many movies where stunt went bad. And a lot of times it went bad because of mathematics. There's this movie Vampire in Brooklyn. One of the few African-American female stunt people. She's dead today. She jumped off the building at the wrong angle.
Wow.
Geometry. She hit the airbag off the wrong spot, died instantly. That's how serious it is to get your math on. But our students don't know this. Video games, they need to know the language of a computer is mathematics.
Yeah.
The computer don't speak Japanese. It don't speak Swahili. He don't speak Espanol. The computer uses what? Binary. So without mathematics, you ain't got no God of War. You don't have no Madden. You don't have any Xbox or PlayStation. Wouldn't that disappoint your children? And wouldn't it give them a greater appreciation for math to let them know, I'm going to buy you this Xbox. But if it wasn't for math, you wouldn't be able to play. Why don't you drop that on? I'll get you the PlayStation. But you can't play nothing if it wasn't for mathematics. Every profession from janitor all the way up to nuclear physicists. You can't do your job without mathematics. I could go on, but we got to move on for time. Now, another thing that has to happen in order to build mathematical power is we have to connect the math world to the children's world, the math world to the students' world, because there is a big disconnect, because they don't see the relevance of it. Let's see if that's in our research. Well, I got to give you the mathematicians. These are some of the great black mathematicians. Okay? Now, there's another slide where I had the female mathematicians. I apologize, but that's on my other PowerPoint. Okay? Oh, here we go. We got them up there. Good. And here's our Hispanic family. See, if I'm a Hispanic student, I need to know somebody look like me can do good at math. If I'm a black student, I need to know somebody that look like me can master math. So I got what? Confidence, fuel, and inspiration.
Yeah.
Look at what these researchers found out. Lower math achievement of minority students, particularly black students, may be indicative of what? The curriculum and the instruction. That's part of the problem. School math, the curriculum, assessment, and pedagogy are all in line, aligned with cultural experiences of the white middle class. And this is why our students are tuned out from the school, because it don't relate to them. And particularly in the math class, if you don't integrate their world with the math world, they are totally tuned out. So what do? They get involved with something else. And then it's how they get suspended and expelled. The math instruction that many black students receive is in opposition to their cultural styles and learning preferences. So it's time that we integrate their world in the math world, or we're going to lose them. It's picture time now. What I'm going to do is take a picture of you all, if you all don't mind.
Is it historically accurate or just Hollywood magic? Welcome to Ms. Mojo, and today we're counting down our picks for the top 10 things Hidden Figures got factually right and wrong.
Dear Lord, I don't even know where to begin.
Oh, I'll tell you where to begin.
For this list, we'll be fact-checking pivotal scenes and storylines from this 2016 drama. Number 10, The Timeline. Wrong. We can't fault them for this decision, because it made the movie move at a much more exciting pace, but the creators of the film condensed many years of history into quite a short timeline.
The Mercury Atlas space vehicle, which will put John Glenn, the first American, into Earth's orbit, has already undergone 5 unmanned flight tests. NASA has confirmed that the IBM 790 data processing system has been utilized to confirm all of the mission's launch and recovery system calculations.
The film kicks off in 1961 and takes place over the following 2 years. But in reality, Mary Jackson became the first black female engineer at NASA in 1958, and Dorothy Vaughan made history by becoming a supervisor nearly a decade earlier in 1949.
If you were a white male, would you wish to be an engineer?
I wouldn't have to. I'd already be one.
All three of the women had many career successes earlier in history, including authoring research reports.
I will have you know, I was the first Negro female student at West Virginia University Graduate School. On any given day, I analyze the manometer level for air displacement, friction, and velocity.
In fact, the West and East computer divisions didn't exist by the end of the 1950s.
Ladies,
we've been reassigned. Leave your calculators, you won't need them where we're going.
Number 9, The Three Women's Closeness. Wrong. This leads to our next point.
Starter is starting to make us late. We all gonna end up unemployed riding around in this pile of junk to work every day.
You're welcome to walk the 16 miles. Or sit in the back of the bus.
Because of the unrealistic timeline, the three main characters in the film, Mary Jackson, Katherine Johnson, and Dorothy Vaughan, didn't actually cross paths as much as in the film. and they definitely weren't close friends who attended events for family milestones.
Captain, go find your way over here. That Colonel Jim is a tall glass of water.
That he is. Tall, strong, commanding.
Oh.
This narrative change put the women together in a variety of scenarios where they actually wouldn't have worked together frequently. Emphasizing their closeness in the film let them express themselves to other women who were in a similar situation to themselves. But it's also not really true.
All under 5'11", 180 pounds, IQ's over 130.
Mm. And handsome must be a requirement too.
How could you possibly be ogling these white men?
Number 8, the police incident. Wrong. Considering the fact that the three women weren't especially good friends, it should come as no surprise that they didn't actually carpool into work together.
Okay, try to turn it over now.
Catherine?
Mary! Somebody!
Catherine, quit staring off in the space and turn the damn car over.
In one memorable scene from the film, we see them having car trouble and being questioned by a police officer when they break down on the side of the road.
That's some. I had no idea they hired.
There are quite a few women working in the space program.
When he learns that they work for NASA, however, he changes his tune and expresses respect for them.
Woo! That a girl. We're all set.
Well, hell, least I can do is give y'all an escort. I imagine you're running late to work.
Oh, no, sir. We wouldn't want to bother
you. That would be wonderful, officer. Thank you so much, sir.
Follow me.
I'm driving. Hurry up, Dorothy, before he changes his mind.
We're coming. Hold your horse.
All of this is fiction. And in fact, Katherine Johnson carpooled with her neighbor and fellow churchgoer Eunice Smith. Number 7, Katherine being told women aren't allowed in briefings. Right. In a memorable scene from the movie, Katherine asks for permission to attend a space program briefing.
Why is it she can't attend? Because she doesn't have clearance, Al.
I cannot do my work effectively if I do not have all of the data and all of the information as soon as it's available. I need to be in that room hearing what you hear.
She's told by head engineer Paul Stafford, played by Jim Parsons, that women don't go to meetings like that one, and that there is no protocol for it.
There is no protocol for a woman
attending
a meeting.
Okay, I get that part, Paul.
But within these walls, who makes the rules?
When she pushes harder, she's eventually allowed to attend. This is how it happened in real life. And Katherine recalls asking if there was a law against women appearing at the briefings. When she found out that there wasn't, she managed to get her way.
You keep quiet.
Thank you.
Number 6, Kevin Costner's character. Wrong. In the film, Kevin Costner plays Al Harrison, the director of the Space Task Group.
And you figured all that out with this. Half the data is redacted.
Well, what's there tells a story if you read between the lines.
But in reality, Harrison was not a real historical figure. The movie's director wasn't able to secure the rights to portray the real person he wanted to, so created a character who was a composite of three different NASA directors. Similarly, Jim Parsons' character Paul Stafford wasn't real, which is for the best considering his racist and sexist attitudes.
Computers don't author reports.
Finally, the woman that Kirsten Dunst played, Vivian Mitchell, is also a fictional creation.
I hear the IBM slept full capacity. You certainly have a knack for it.
My father taught me a thing or two about mechanics.
Number 5, getting rid of the segregated toilet. Wrong. In one of the most satisfying moments in the movie, Kevin Costner's character dramatically smashes the sign for the, quote, colored ladies' bathroom. There are a few problems with this scene. First, Kevin Costner's character didn't exist. And second, segregation ended at Langley in 1958. Some critics argue that this created an unnecessary white savior moment.
There you have it. No more colored restrooms. No more white restrooms.
The movie's screenwriter and director, Theodore Melfi, countered that, quote, there needs to be white people who do the right thing. There needs to be black people who do the right thing. And someone does the right thing.
Go wherever you damn well please. Preferably closer to your desk.
And so who cares who does the right thing as long as the right thing is achieved?
Here at NASA, we all pee the same color.
The critics weren't impressed. Number 4, Katherine Johnson computing John Glenn's trajectory. Right. John Glenn's orbit of the Earth made history in 1962 when he became the first American to do so. In the movie, we see Catherine working on Glenn's trajectory, which was totally accurate.
Okay, so that puts your landing zone at 5.0667 degrees north, 77.3333 degrees west, which is here. Right here.
Perhaps more surprising, though, is that when the IBM computer seemed to be giving them inconsistent numbers, Glenn really did ask for Johnson specifically to check the figures for him, and said that he was willing to fly that day if she confirmed them.
We're on the same page, John. Our guys are on it.
Let's get the girl to check the numbers.
The girl?
Yes, sir.
You mean Catherine?
Yes, sir. The smart one. I mean, she says they're good. I'm ready to go.
Margot Lee Setterly, the author of the book Hidden Figures, said, quote, "So the astronaut who became a hero looked to this black woman, in the still segregated South at the time, as one of the key parts of making sure his mission would be a success."
I like her numbers.
Number 3, Catherine running half a mile to use the bathroom. Wrong.
Where the hell have you been? Everywhere I look, you're not where I need you to be. It's not my imagination. Now, where the hell do you go every day?
To the bathroom, sir.
To the bathroom. To the damn bathroom. For 40 minutes a day?
One of the main devices used to expose the racism of mid-20th century America was the fact that Katherine Johnson had to walk half a mile to another building in order to use the colored bathroom. But in fact, it was Mary Jackson who encountered this problem, not Johnson.
There's no bathroom for me here.
What do you mean there's no bathroom for you here?
There is no bathroom. There are no colored bathrooms in this building or any building outside the West Campus, which is half a mile away.
Both had started at Langley before the NACA became NASA, which saw segregated facilities abolished. However, Catherine actually hadn't realized that the East Side bathrooms were segregated and used the white bathrooms for years. There was a complaint at one point, but she ignored it, and there were no consequences.
Excuse me if I have to go to the restroom a few times a day.
Number 2, Catherine's experience with workplace racism. Wrong. While in the movie, Catherine takes a stand against the segregation at NASA, the real Catherine has stated that racism didn't affect her much in her workplace.
My uniform, skirt below my knees, my heels, and a simple string of pearls. Well, I don't own pearls. Lord knows you don't pay colors enough to afford pearls.
When she spoke to WHRO-TV, she said, quote,
I didn't feel the segregation at NASA because everybody there was doing research. You had a mission and you worked on it. Mm-hmm. And it was important to you to do your job and play bridge at lunch.
Perhaps to reflect practices elsewhere and to make the movie more dramatic, the film creators included it anyway.
They've never had a colored in here before, Catherine. Don't embarrass me.
Before we continue, be sure to subscribe to our channel and ring the bell to get notified about our latest videos. You have the option to be notified for occasional videos or all of them. If you're on your phone, make sure you go into your settings and switch on notifications. Number 1, segregation laws at Langley. Right. In 1943, when black women began working as computers at Virginia's Langley campus, segregation was very real in the state.
I'll check her credentials. I think I come all the way down here.
It was mandated that there be separate workspaces, cafeterias, and bathrooms for black and white people.
We don't want any trouble in here.
Oh, I'm not here for any trouble, ma'am.
What are you here for?
A book.
You have books in the colored section?
As Hidden Figures author Margot Lee Shetterly describes it, quote, even though they were just starting these brand new, very interesting jobs as professional mathematicians, they nonetheless had to abide by the state law. The reality is, though, that segregation ended at the Langley Research Center when NASA was formed in 1958, which was before the movie takes place.
Separate and equal are two different things. Just cause it's the way doesn't make it right. Understand?
Yes, ma'am.
You act right, you are right.
Do you agree with our picks? Check out this other recent clip from Ms. Mojo. And be sure to subscribe and ring the bell.
Houston, we have a problem.
Movies about the American space program almost always feature white men.
I had no idea they hired
quite a few women working in the space program.
But one new film breaks with that trend.
She can handle any numbers you put in front of her.
Hidden Figures tells the true story of the black women mathematicians who work behind the scenes to help launch Americans into orbit for the first time at the height of the civil rights movement in the South.
What do you ladies do for NASA?
Calculate your trajectory.
The film centers around the life of Katherine Johnson, who's played by Taraji P. Henson. Dexter Thomas visited the real Katherine Johnson at her home in Virginia.
What do you think needs to be shown of your life?
They can show you where I lived and what trouble I got into.
What kind of trouble did you get into?
Can't tell it.
Katherine Johnson just turned 98.
Can't tell it.
She started her career as a computer at the Langley Research Center in Virginia in 1953, calculating and plotting test data. Her calculations helped launch the first American into orbit and were used for America's first moon landing. Graduating summa cum laude from college at the age of 18, becoming a career mathematician seemed to be the most natural fit.
There's a lot of other things you could have done. What was it about math that made you think, I want to do this with my life?
To show it could be done, and that it was so easy to do.
I've got to say, math did not come easy for me, I think, for a lot of people.
Why not? Did your mother like math?
My mom did like math, yeah.
Well, usually when they said their mother didn't like math, but I found it very useful.
Black women who worked at NASA had to deal with both sexism and racism in the segregated South. The movie does a great job of showing their struggles, but it's not a documentary. It's a Hollywood dramatization.
I can keep up in that world.
One scene shows Katherine Johnson having to walk a half mile every day just to use a colored bathroom until her white boss steps in to save the day.
We all get to the peak together, or we don't get there at all.
Johnson says that never happened.
Did you have to use a colored woman's bathroom?
I just went on in the white one.
You just went in the white woman's restroom. You just used whatever bathroom you wanted to use.
I asked the film's director, Ted Melfi, why he wanted to include a scene that never happened. He said he's focused on the overall message of the movie.
You know, when you're making a film, you want to dramatize the plight. And the plight was everyone of color had to use that colored bathroom. So she being a woman of color, represented everyone that had to use those bathrooms.
Yeah. I guess I wonder about, basically the white dude is the one who comes to and says, segregation is over.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in reality, at least for this one woman, she's the one who decided, I'm going to the white bathroom, forget y'all. Does it diminish at all what Katherine Johnson did in real life by refusing to go to the bathroom?
Not for me. People might say, oh, it's a white savior. The white saviors.
White savior complex?
Savior complex.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of the bigger issue as well. I mean, yes, there needs to be white people that do the right thing and black people that do the right thing and someone does the right thing. And so who cares? It does the right thing as long as the right thing is achieved. So that's how I took it.
Just like her real-life bravery, Katherine Johnson's greatest achievements were behind the scenes. But she said she would have been more than happy to switch roles if she had the chance.
Did you ever want to be the person going up to space?
Yeah, if they had offered me a ride, I would have gone in a minute to see what was out there.
Hello, my name is Victoria Vaca. I am a senior at Elizabeth City State University majoring in mathematics. I am also in the accelerated master's program. My presentation is about Marjorie Lee Brown and her life story. Marjorie Lee Brown was born on September 9, 1914. She was born in Memphis, Tennessee. During this time, discrimination was still present in society. Her mother died when she was 2 years old, so she never really got to know her. Her father remarried not long after, so Marjorie still had a mother figure in her life. Her father and stepmother were among the more educated African Americans in Memphis, Tennessee. Her father was known in Memphis for being good with numbers. Her stepmother was a school teacher. Marjorie Lee Brown was naturally good when it came to mathematics, so they made sure she would have the opportunity to go far in the math field. Marjorie Lee Brown had to push herself to show her worth so the world would not put her down, since she was not only an African American, but she was also a woman. Her father sent her to a private high school, LeMonnier High School. This school was created after the Civil War to help educate African Americans. When it was finally time for Marjorie Lee Brown to begin college, it was during the Depression. She was determined to go to college, so she got loans, held a job, and received scholarships. The first college she attended was Howard University in Washington, D.C. Marjorie Lee Brown graduated cum laude with her bachelor's degree in 1935. She moved to New Orleans, Louisiana after she graduated. Marjorie Lee Brown began teaching mathematics at Gilbert Academy. This was a private secondary school for African American students. She only taught here for a year before returning to school to continue her education. Marjorie Lee Brown moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan to attend the University of Michigan. She graduated with her master's degree in mathematics in 1939. At this time, Marjorie Lee Brown was one of the few female African Americans to have a graduate level mathematics degree. She moved to Marshall, Texas after she graduated. Marjorie Lee Brown began teaching at Wiley College. During her summer breaks, she would take classes at the University of Michigan. She was now working toward her doctorate in mathematics. Marjorie Lee Brown moved back to Ann Arbor in 1947. She became a teaching fellow, which would help pay for her tuition while she finished her doctorate in mathematics. In 1949, she graduated from the University of Michigan with her doctorate in mathematics. Her dissertation was published in the American Mathematical Monthly sometime between June and July 1955. Some question whether or not Marjorie Lee Brown received her doctorate in mathematics in 1949. The doubt comes from the fact that the earliest graduation she could have attended was in February of 1950. Either way, Marjorie Lee Brown is still remembered as the third female African American to receive a doctorate in mathematics in society, as these women were gaining more knowledge and more voice. Marjorie Lee Brown chose to move to Durham, North Carolina after she graduated. She became a professor at North Carolina College, now known as North Carolina Central University. The classes she taught included both undergraduate and graduate classes. Only 2 years after teaching there, she became the chair of the mathematics department in 1951. Marjorie Lee Brown held this position for 19 years until she stepped down in 1970. Marjorie Lee Brown worked for North Carolina Central University for 30 years. Out of those 30 years, Marjorie Lee Brown was the only one with a doctorate in mathematics for 25 years. During her time there, she held many positions, including chair of the mathematics department, principal investigator, coordinator of the mathematics section, and lecturer of the Summer Institute for Secondary School Science and Mathematics Teachers. Marjorie Lee Brown was also able to be an advisor for 10 master's degrees in mathematics. During her time at North Carolina Central University, Marjorie Lee Brown accomplished a lot. Between 1952 to 1953, she won a Ford Foundation Fellowship. This was to study combinatorial topology at Cambridge University and to travel throughout Western Europe. The Ford Foundation is known to offer grants to innovative people and institutions worldwide. Topology ended up becoming Marjorie Lee Brown's specialty. Marjorie Lee Brown was also able to study computing and numerical analysis. She did this while she was a National Science Foundation faculty fellow at the University of California. She wrote four sets of lecture notes that would become published. In 1960, while she was still the chair of mathematics department, she received a $60,000 grant from IBM. This was to set up an electronic computer center, which was one of the first at a minority college. Between 1965 to 1966, Marjorie Lee Brown won another fellowship where she studied differential topology at Columbia University. It was because of her lecture notes and her involvement in the continuation of education for secondary teachers. In 1969, she received the first Shell grant for her department. This grant was used to award outstanding mathematics students. In 1975, Marjorie Lee Brown was the very first recipient of the W.W. Rankin Memorial Award for Excellence in Mathematics Education. Marjorie Lee Brown retired from North Carolina Central University in 1979. Her goal in life was to continue to help the mathematical community. She wanted to help gifted mathematics students pursue a good education, so she used her money to help them achieve that. Marjorie Lee Brown wanted them to have opportunity to accomplish what they were truly capable of, like her parents had done for her. Marjorie Lee Brown ended up passing away in 1979, the same year that she had retired from North Carolina Central University. She had died from a heart attack on October 19, 1979. The University of Michigan now honors her with a lecture series they started in 2001. Marjorie Lee Brown was an amazing woman, not only because of how much she accomplished, but by how she helped others pursue an education.
Hey guys, it's Lisa Ren, back to another video. I took a brief break from filming for a little while because I was recovering from the flu. I actually tried to record this video while I had the flu, and I literally had to stop every 30 seconds and put my head down because I was just so exhausted. But I am feeling much better now. It's been about 4 days, 5 days, and I'm feeling a lot better now than I was feeling previously. I actually put a question on Instagram: what are some remedies that you guys have for the flu? And a lot of people gave me some really good tips. So thank you for everybody that chimed in with various tips and tricks. But Hidden Figures. This Hidden Figures video is Etta Zuber Falconer, born November 21st, 1933, died September 19th, 2002. Falconer was an educator and mathematician, the bulk of whose career was spent at college, where she eventually served as department head and associate provost. She was one of the earlier Black American women to receive a PhD in mathematics. Etta Zuber was born in Tupelo, Mississippi, home of Ray Shurmur, to Walter A. Zuber, a physician, and Sadie L. Montgomery Zuber, a musician. The Zubers had two daughters, with Etta being the younger and Alice the older. Etta Falconer attended the Tupelo public school system, graduating from George Washington High School in 1949. At the age of 15, she entered Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee, where she majored in mathematics and minored in chemistry, graduating summa cum laude in 1953. While at Fisk, Falconer was inducted into the Phi Beta Kappa Academic Honor Society. Falconer began her teaching career in 1954 at Okolona Junior College, where she met and married Dean Falconer, a basketball coach. They have three children, Dolan Falconer Jr., who became a nuclear engineer, Alice Falconer Wilson, a pediatrician, and Walter Zuber Falconer, a urologist. The couple's marriage lasted over 35 years, ended by Dolan's death. She remained at Okolona until 1963, when she accepted a position at Howard High School in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where she taught the academic year 1963 through 1964. When her husband was offered a coaching position at Morris Brown College in 1965, the family moved to Atlanta, also the site of Spelman College, a historically black women's college. Falconer's mother had studied at Spelman, and Falconer approached the head of the mathematics department, telling him that she wanted to teach there. She was appointed an instructor in 1965. Falconer advanced to associate professor, leaving Spelman in 1971 to join the mathematics department in Norfolk State University, where she taught for the academic year 1971 through 1972. Falconer returned to Spelman as a professor of mathematics and head of the mathematics department after that. After the family moved to Atlanta, she entered graduate school at Emory University. At Emory, she earned a PhD in mathematics in 1969 with a dissertation on abstract algebra. To assist in setting up a computer science department while mathematics head at Spelman College, she returned to graduate school at Atlanta University, earning a Master of Science degree in computer science in 1982. Falconer devoted 37 years of her life to teaching mathematics and improving science education at Spelman College. In 1995, she stated, "My entire career has been devoted to increasing the number of African-American women in mathematics and mathematics-related careers." In 1995, Falconer was honored by the Association for Women in Mathematics, who awarded her the Lewis Hay Award for Outstanding Achievements in Mathematics Education. In 2001, she received the American Academy of Arts and Sciences Mentor Award for Lifetime Achievement. She is recognized by her peers in the profession as being one of the most influential and respected leaders in mathematics and science education. Etta Zuber Falconer, Hidden Figures. Hopefully you guys enjoyed this one. See you all next time. Peace.
Are dozens of people tonight showing up for the unveiling of a bronze bust for the first African-American math professor over at Baylor University. Fox 44's Renee Summerauer live tonight at Baylor with more on that emotional ceremony.
Yeah, Robert, you can see the bust right behind me of Professor and Dr. Vivienne Malone Mays. And what an amazing story she had. Speakers here at Baylor, faculty members, family, and speakers from near and far coming here to not only talk about her trials and tribulations, but the barriers she was able to break, not only here at Baylor, but at other schools here in Texas. Now, as you look at some of the video, Dr. Mays' daughter was also here to accept the statue in her mother's honor, along with other faculty members who all spoke at today's ceremony. They not only talked about her struggles as a black student at the in the state of Texas, but her perseverance and love for the subject of math and her love for teaching and for her students. Now, Dr. Robert Darden, who got emotional and had some powerful words during his dedication, says that he hopes students will look at this statue and see Dr. Mays as a noteworthy figure for the past and hopefully a positive inspiration for the future.
I want them to see that and not think of something that's in the past, but it's an inspiration for the future, and that if Baylor's not going to do a better job, then they need to do a better job of demanding that Baylor be more inclusive, that Baylor be more diverse. I'm giving you my money. I want to see people who look like me in administration. I want to see more faculty who look like me. It's up to the students. That's what I want them to see.
Yeah, just some powerful words there by Dr. Darden. Now, coming up tonight at 9 o'clock, we talk to Dr. Mays' daughter, who is here to accept the bust in her honor, along with some of the other speakers who made an appearance here at today's ceremony. Live at Baylor, Renee Summerauer, Fox 44 News.